You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson, and we are today, Wednesday, March 25th of 2020. For those of you who subscribe to my Patreon page, I have an essay there giving my point of view on the coronavirus disaster. It's something that I certainly didn't predict. I don't know of anyone who predicted something like this. But its implications, I don't mean its implications biologically. It's not much of a threat. The implications politically and legally are what worries me, and I think most people at this point. The death rate is nothing compared to what influenza is every year. Somehow that's been forgotten. The death rate of everything from, you know, SARS to Zika was far greater than this virus without this incredible lockdown. Most of the world is unaffected. Most of the countries in Europe, especially in Eastern Europe, and in Northern Europe, have pretty much zero deaths. But when you see a headline that says India's fatality rate goes up to 5, martial law declared, you know, and not laugh, this is something that is, as I've said many times, is Gagarin. And its surreality. And so I want to resist talking about it, partially because everyone's talking about it. And I don't like to be dictated to as to what I discuss. Please go to my Patreon page, which you can get from my own website, of course, rushjournal.org, and read it for yourself. And I have quite a bit of information, of course, that's not getting out in public. I make no pretension of being a virologist, but there are certainly dissenting virologists out there that are not being heard. The only thing I'll say in conclusion, of course, is that the banks are getting an interest-free loan of about $1 trillion a day from the Fed. The depression that I've been saying, as you know, for years, now they could claim has come, and of course it's not their fault, it's the virus's fault. The disastrous economy that they have created at our expense now could be blamed on the virus. They're already calling this the corona depression. Enough about that. Enough is being spoken about it both in the alternative press as well as in the mainstream. That's all anyone's talking about. So I'm going to resist talking about it further, except to laugh at those kind of headlines. You know, India had its 5th death, so I guess, well, that takes care of that civilization. It's almost surreal. But March of 2020 is an anniversary. And by the way, before I get into this, I know everyone is struggling, some more than others. I do desperately need your assistance financially. Things are getting worse. And of course, because of this, you know, that's fallen off. And I get it, of course. But please consider it. If you haven't donated to me, please do so. This is a full-time job, and I desperately need your assistance. Getting hot water one of these days would be nice. But, you know, we're ascetics, so this is kind of what we do. And for those who have donated, I thank you very, very, very much. Yes, 1920, 2020, that 100 years. This is certainly an anniversary, and it's a very depressing one. Back in 2018, I published a book and did two podcasts, among many other things, for the 100th anniversary of the murder of the royal family. Now, we're at the 100th anniversary of the defeat of the White Army in the Russian Revolution, the Russian Civil War. I deal with this issue to some extent in my book, The Soviet Experiment. It was published by the Barnes Review. I've dealt with this issue in other places, especially the concern, and one of my big issues in my whole career, of course, is dispelling the mythology that the Western powers, I should say the Entente, the Allies, were fighting Bolshevism and were doing all they could to support the White Armies in their fight against the Reds. That myth is everywhere, and even very intelligent people have fallen for it. The assumption is that somehow the West is ideologically anti-communist, which has never been the case, never will be the case. I know there's obviously no connection, what's going on now versus the defeat of the white forces. I'm not making that claim at all. It's just very interesting to note that exactly 100 years ago in Russia, their lives were changed permanently and absolutely for the worst. February 7th of 1920, the White Army, the great leader, Admiral Alexander Kolchak, was captured and executed. At the same time, Yudenich's army was evacuated from Estonia. So this period, February, November, roughly, 1920, is the darkest period in Russian history. In 2018, the Russian embassy in the U.S. issued a statement talking about the bloody American intervention in suffering Russia. Now, normally, the Russian government is something that I support, but when it comes to this issue and World War II, I vehemently deny what they say. It's all the media. And talk about the so-called intervention of 14 states, supposedly in support of the White Army's overthrow Soviet power. Somehow, the Russian Foreign Ministry has identified themselves with the Bolsheviks. You know, propaganda from the Soviet Union always dissociated themselves from pre-revolutionary Russia. But certain people today want to associate them together, come from this delusion of Soviet patriotism. It's trying to square a circle, and it's an area of vehement disagreement. Between the Russian government and myself. No one's a greater defender of Putin and the Russian government under him than I've been, but in this area, they couldn't be more wrong. Now, of course, the context in complaining about American intervention is challenging all the nonsense about the election interference. And so the context, I understand why they're saying what they're saying, but what they're saying is wrong. Now, the key to the civil war in Russia is the White Army itself, or I should say the White Armies. They were a disparate group of men, based often on very eccentric, very talented personalities. But they weren't initially called the White Army. They were the Volunteer Army, first of all. But the Soviet Encyclopedia says this about where the name came from. They write, "The origin of the term White Guard is associated with the symbolism of the color white as the color of the supporters of the legal rule of law, as opposed to red, the color of the rebellious people in the revolution. During the French Revolution, under the banners were images of white lilies, which was the emblem of the monarchy, and under that banner the counter-revolutionary nobility appeared." So anyway, the white soldiers like this definition. The white color is very important in Russia, and most Aryan societies have this association with purity, chastity, nobility, freedom, even regality. The beginning of the White Army, the Volunteer Army, would be November 2nd or 15th, 1917. Right after the Bolshevik coup, the Volunteer Army of General Alexeyev was mobilized on the Don. Shortly thereafter, the Northern Army of General Evgeny Miller was formed in Arkhangelsk. Miller then made an attempt to unite with the Siberian Army of Alexander Kolchak in the direction of Vyatka. Miller and Kornilov came together because they vehemently opposed the democratization of the army after the February Revolution. Remember, the period between February and October, the rule of the provisional government versus the rule of the Bolsheviks. And both governments tried to democratize the army. Order number one of the provisional government was to permit the election of committees of soldiers, regardless of rank, that would then control much of army life. Now, in December, Lenin would issue a decree that did away with all ranks and have command be an entirely elective process. All privileges associated with ranks were eliminated. And Trotsky called the democratization of the provisional government the only worthwhile thing the February Revolution ever did. Now, in both cases, the moderate white version or the extreme red version, they didn't last. The provisional government, after order number one, issued order number two and order number three, which then tried to deny order number one. And this kind of confusion is probably why the February government fell. The greatest success of the white forces was in the liberation of Siberia and the Ural Mountains, guaranteeing them access to the Volga in the spring, roughly the spring of 1919. General Denikin's forces came within 200 miles of Moscow in October. At the very same time, Yudenich threatened Petrograd. In the fall of 1919, the Northwest Army of Yudenich was driven back to Estonia. And what few people realize is that under the command of the British, the Estonians interred Yudenich's army in concentration camps. Only a handful, including Yudenich himself, were able to escape. The Siberian army of Kolchak, from the middle of 1919, was forced to retreat, betrayed by the Entente, was captured by the Reds in early 1920. In February, of course, he was executed by them. The Northern Army of General Miller was forced to stop fighting in February of 1920, having escaped to Finland and Norway and elsewhere. Yudenich, keeping white generals straight is often very difficult. There's so many personalities here. There's so many white armies. Now, we all know the big names, like Denikin and Kolchak, and we know all that, but there's many others that were significant, but much smaller. But one of the big names, of course, is Yudenich, who was a very experienced and talented leader. But the reasons for his defeat were purely political. He had to deal with negotiations with the Baltic states and Finland that were also taking orders from Britain for trade concessions. The Finns had every intention of assisting Yudenich, but he had to accept Finnish independence as a price. See, what people don't realize is that at the time, very few people knew what the Bolsheviks were all about. In the West, almost no one did. Even in places like Finland, right on the border, they weren't aware of what the real agenda was. They spoke often in libertarian terms, having no intention of actually ruling that way. Because the white armies overwhelmingly wanted a unified Russia, they preferred the Reds to the whites. Because Lenin was a manipulator, unlike the whites. And he was telling everyone what they wanted to hear for support, then turning on them once they took over. The other problem is that people like Yudinich and Denikin and all these guys couldn't believe that the West was supporting the Bolsheviks. Even Hitler was shocked. How can you support these people? Long after they knew what they were all about. And so they were all expecting the support of the British. So there was no way they could support the Bolsheviks. These were Tsarist generals during the Great War. But they provided absolutely nothing except demanding the independence of the Baltic states. The Bolshevik government was more advantageous for them. So Yudenich received nothing. He didn't receive any support from Finland. The European part of Russia, the last troops of General Wrangel, resisted in Crimea until 1920, evacuating to Turkey. Then, of course, you have the marches. Troops under the command of Adam and Alexander Dutov held out until March of 1920, exactly 100 years ago. The Ural Cossacks by Tolstoy went through the Trans-Caspian steppes, hoping to get to Mesopotamia. The marches are, well, the two big ones are the Starvation March and the Great Ice March, by two armies in response to the fall of the provisional capital at Omsk in Siberia. The Starvation March was an attempt by Adam and Dutov to reach Siberia in the Far East under the control of Adam and Anenkov on the Chinese border. He was cut off from Colonel Koppel, whose ice march took him in a different direction. But in his case, it was almost a 2,000-mile retreat of that part of Kolchak's Siberian army from Omsk to Chita from November to March, ending in March of 1920, again, 100 years ago. Chita's on the border of Mongolia and was under Japanese control. See, once Denikin was defeated, Western cash flowed to the Reds like never before. Once the whites were not really a viable force anymore, they were able to throw everything they had against the white stronghold in the east. Now, the Ice March was a success. They did escape. The Starvation March ended in failure. The Reds captured the basically 20% of the men and their families that survived. And the Ural Army Death March, January of 1920, Guarov, the city was taken by the Reds. General Tolstoy decided to march south, hoping to unite with the army in Turkestan under Boris Kazanovich. So again, another caravan, about 15,000 people, including women and children, headed south along the coast of the Caspian Sea under the harshest possible conditions, deserted landscape, icy winds, minus 30, absence of drinking water. The time they arrived, their destination, maybe 3,000 Cossacks remained from the army, and most of them were already in various stages of either frostbite or typhus. And most of them were killed at the Fort Alexandrovsk in April of 1920. The Ural Army had ceased to exist at that point. A tiny handful, about 214, survived. 162 ended up making the trip and made it to Persia by June. Now, these marches never got the press of the long march that the Red Chinese received. Most people have never heard of these marches before. These are marches of thousands of miles of people desperately escaping the Bolsheviks. If you're going to be in a caravan walking 2,000 miles, you must be running from something pretty awful. But the whites and these marches, even despite the fact that they lost, saved the honor of the Russian people. Their feats are always going to remain proof that no one chose Bolshevism, but they resisted to the very end. Lenin wrote, "For 3 years, the Russian, French, and Japanese armies were in the territory, were in our country. There's no doubt that the most insignificant action of these forces, these three powers, would be quite enough to defeat us in a few months, if not several weeks." So any foreign soldiers in Russia could have very easily toppled the Soviet power. And they were very much aware of this. Of course, there was no intervention of 14 states against the Soviet Republic and other nonsense. Foreign troops were all over the Russian Empire at the time, but it had nothing to do with ideology. It had nothing to do with overthrowing Bolshevism. Quite the contrary. Now, there's two distinct periods in this intervention. The first is during the war and after 1918, after November of 1918. Two very different periods in foreign intervention in the Civil War. And the end of World War I altered the nature and purpose of these foreign armies in Russia. The German army occupied the Baltic states, southern Russia, and Ukraine to replenish their reserves. Germany assisted the Reds in taking over, and of course they got the Brest Peace as a treaty as a result. It was very important for the Germans to control the new government in Russia so that the Eastern Front would not be restored. The Germans gave tons of money and advisors to the Red Army, even demanding that other countries recognize them. And of course, the Treaty of Brest-Litovsk, Germany received huge chunks of Russian territory, and not just, you know, most of Western Russia, the most industrialized and populated parts of Western Russia. The German State Secretary, von Kuhlmann, instructed his ambassador in Moscow. He wrote this to him: "Please use large sums, since we are extremely interested in the Bolsheviks surviving. We are not interested in supporting the royalist idea that will reunite Russia. On the contrary, we should try to prevent the consolidation of Russia as much as possible, and from this point of view, we must support the extreme left party." And this is an extremely short-sighted policy. So the very end of the German effort in World War I was dedicated to overthrowing not just the Russian crown, but installing the Reds, precisely because they would create a civil war in Russia and keep them out of any war against them, not thinking that that might spill over to them. Which, of course, it did. The German representative in Moscow, Denikin wrote that they were extraditing officers to the Cheka because they viewed the army of Denikin as an ally of the Allies, of the Entente. So the only reason that they landed in Russia in 1918 is in the hope of restoring the Eastern Front against Germany. Churchill, in July of 1919, said in the British Parliament, explaining the landings the year prior, said that the only reason that they were there, that the Germans would have seized all the resources of Russia and the Allied blockade would have been overthrown. That's why they were there. The landing in Murmansk in March of 1918 was an attempt to keep the Germans from using it as a submarine base. And Trotsky was a part of this. He sent his order to the Murmansk Council that the Allies should land there and be treated very well. Arkhangelsk, the same thing. The commander of the Entente Expeditionary Force, he wrote, "It was extremely important to save a huge number of military depots so that the Germans cannot get military property acquired by Tsarist Russia in the United States and England." to the troops that were sent were, they came roughly about 7,500 Americans, 4,000 Canadians, 2,000 Italians, maybe 1,500 British and 1,000 French in different parts of the country in the summer of 1918. Not to mention the fact, the added complication of the Czechoslovakian Corps, and partially some Austrian POWs sympathetic with them, and using them, that were first-rate soldiers, to restore the anti-German front. But none of this has to do with being against the Bolsheviks. So both the Germans and the Allies fought the whites. The interventionists remained in Siberia, guarding their railway interests there. And really the only force capable of any offensive operation with the Japanese. And the only thing that Japan worried about was the economic exploitation of the Far East. They had 70,000 men near Vladivostok in 1918. They did not help Kolchak whatsoever, although they could have. They could have by themselves destroyed the early USSR. The Czechoslovakian Corps is often misunderstood. They were the only foreign unit that took part in the hostilities on the side of the whites, but only until the end of the war. Remember, these were Czech nationalists used by the Russian army during World War I. They were not part of the Central Powers. The POWs, of course, were. And they saw the Reds as German agents, so they were vehemently opposed to them, because they didn't want to use the ports that were blocked or, you know, in flames at the time. Tomas Masaryk wanted them to go east and evacuate them through Vladivostok and bring them to France to continue the war there. Because Trotsky didn't trust them, he insisted they be disarmed, which of course they refused, and they came under General Dietrichs, probably my favorite white general, in the Far East. And they even overthrew the Vladivostok Soviet. The American involvement in Russia was to assist the evacuation of the Czech Legion. But because of all the fighting that they did, they didn't leave until September of 1920. About 60,000 men left, and many of them became part of the Foreign Legion, in fact. In the summer of 1918, the whites managed to seize the gold reserves of pre-revolutionary Russia, which had been shipped to Kazan for safekeeping. You're talking about tons and tons and tons of gold and platinum and jewelry. The only reason that the whites had any interest in helping the white, the Western financiers had any interest in helping the whites initially was to get their hands on this money. Now, they received very little early on, and only during the war. And because you know, Kolchak was able to get his hands on these funds, this is how he was able to create some kind of central authority. Never in reality, but he was able to finance many of the others. But he couldn't use this money. If you want any proof that the West was at war with the whites in favor of the Reds, it's in the fact that he had tons of gold and no one wanted to sell to him. Significant amounts of military equipment which he could afford were delayed and no explanation was ever given. Tons of gold were sent by Kolchak to Japan and even San Francisco. He was being scammed. They had no intention of sending him anything. Now, in the Romanian city of Iasi, in November of 1918, the end of the war, the Allied diplomatic missions met with a delegation of mostly leftist anti-Bolshevik groups that arose, the Socialist Renaissance Union, the Cadet National Center, the Council of State, some groups like this. And they thought that the Entente would now send troops to help their Russian ally free it from its German allies. From these German allies, the Reds being considered German allies. The Russian Expeditionary Force fought in France. But the minutes of the meeting show that at least the military commanders of the Western powers had interest in assisting these groups. They didn't recognize the Soviet government. And they accepted the White Volunteer Army only because they rejected the Brest-Litovsk capitulation. And of course wanted this, you know, battle to continue. And this meeting, which at the time was, there was a lot of high hopes put on this. Denikin headed the Volunteer Army after the deaths of Alexeyev and Kornilov, became commander-in-chief of the Russian delegation in Yassi. He became the representative of Russia in international affairs. In fact, it was thought that this delegation was going to be the core of the new Russian government. And here's what they said. In their note addressed to the Allied command, the Russian delegation said, "The suffering of the people living under this regime, the most cruel and senseless tyranny, is great and measurable. If the countries of the Entente want to see a new Russia strong and healthy, member of the family of civilized peoples, these countries do not want the population of the north of Russia to die in hundreds of thousands by starvation. These countries recognize that Russia during the first years of the war took her enormous and glorious participation, making a great contribution to the final victory. And precisely because of her efforts to defeat the common enemy, efforts that surpassed the national forces elsewhere, she experienced all the unspeakable misfortunes that crushes her. In a word, if the victorious Entente has unwaveringly decided to revive Russia, the assistance they will provide should neither be too late nor insignificant. We have no doubt that the Allies already worked out a number of measures as decisive and wise to eliminate the ulcer of Bolshevism." Now, this is pure naivete. Naivete that is going to be found over and over again, not just during the Civil War, but even afterwards. As it turns out, these representatives of the Entente really didn't have any authority for serious negotiations. Almost at the initiative it really was just almost an irresponsible exchange of thinking aloud. N.V. Savitz, one of the Russian participants, said this later on. The Western representatives promised assistance to the Russian forces. But these were relatively low-level diplomatic cadres. They weren't plenipotentiaries. And they were scammed yet again. They had no intention of following through in any of this. The war in Europe was not why the military supplies were delayed. The French foreign minister, Pichon, explained in Parliament. He said, "All our interventions in Russia over the past year, everything we did against the Bolsheviks was actually done against Germany." Then when the war ended, Churchill said, "All arguments that could lead to intervention now have disappeared." So those two comments put the whole anti-Bolshevik stuff to bed permanently. You have two leaders saying that they had nothing to do with Bolshevism. They had troops there, but it was solely as an anti-German measure. But what begins to happen, and one of the reasons that the Whites failed, is when I read what the Russian delegation had said to the Yassi conference with these people who apparently didn't have much power, or had no intention of following through, telling them what they wanted to hear, talking about, you know, the new Russia, strong and healthy, civilized family of nations, etc., attempting to promote themselves as liberals, which is what Denikin tried to do. Fails completely. No one is going to be mobilized by this sloganeering. They never received any kind of recognition from the Entente. In January of 1919, the Entente said that you need to begin peace negotiations with the Bolsheviks. Because they knew that they had financial interests there and a new government was forming, they had soldiers there to protect their interests and to assure their influence with the Reds. They said to the Whites, you have no chance of winning. Essentially, we're already on their side. They've taken over, so you need to engage in peace negotiations. And they even tried to claim that Lenin was going to put forward an amnesty and to reintegrate the White Army into the Red Army. Of course, it didn't fool anybody, but it shows you just how bad the situation was. The British, of course, were interested in the Baku oil fields in today's Azerbaijan. And by November of 1919, they occupied Baku and the railway to the point of Batumi. Some of the white colonels said at the time that the British were building up the Georgian resistance to the White Army. They were very hostile to them, including the persecution of the church. The Nikit even went so far as to ask the British, are we dealing with allies or enemies? It was very clear what side they were on, and it certainly wasn't the white side. Throughout the war, the whites were constantly running out of ammunition. They didn't have the heavy weapons that the Reds did. The Reds never had a supply problem. The British showed up at the end of 1918, after the Germans left, to support the independent Baltic states. In August of 1919, the English emissary appointed a government under General Yudenich solely to support Baltic independence. Any assistance to the white forces was based on that. They had to make peace with the Reds, they had to be a liberal democracy, and they had to support all of these new states. But even if he was willing to do this, they would receive nothing. After Yudenich failed to take Petrograd, at the request of Trotsky, the Estonian nationalists disarmed the White Army and put them in camps, as I mentioned already. On February 2nd of 1920, the Bolsheviks could export gold from the Tallinn port, and the White Army there was interred. The typhus took about 4,000 white soldiers, and they were also used for forced labor. The Red Cross came in and improved their conditions somewhat, but that's hardly assistance to the White Army. Anti-Semitism was one of the reasons the British had refused anything to do with Yudenich's forces, refusing to accept the idea that Bolsheviks were essentially a Jewish movement. So the independent Estonian army, along with the Reds, was able to disarm and inter the White Army, and Yudenich personally was able to escape the concentration camp. They killed at least 4,000 of them. France was more blatant about it. It wanted its stake and influence in Odessa and Sevastopol, sending its men to replace the retreating Germans. They wanted an alliance with the Ukrainian Directory, which failed miserably in every way. The French occupied Kherson and Nikolaev, even close to Odessa. But even then, the first time the Reds ever threatened them at any level whatsoever, even though they had three times the men, they evacuated. They took Russian military ships and all the cash of the state bank from the White Army, and nothing was transferred to the Whites. Those were left, in fact, to the Bolsheviks. The French backed the Reds entirely there. And they humiliated the white forces again, whites being unable to understand how the French, after everything that these generals had done for the Entente during the war, could support these allies of the Germans. The French emissary presented to the Ataman of the Don Cossacks, Krasnov, the conditions: if you want to be recognized and get aid from us, They demanded full compensation to French entrepreneurs for any losses incurred due to the war, lack of order in the country. Compensate the lost ability to work, families of those killed as a result of the violence. They even had a scale of average profitability, a bunch you would have to pay in compensation, and a 5% bonus for every time, for every month that these businesses couldn't function, starting in 1914. Obviously impossible for them to come up with this kind of money. The French at this point were openly backing the Bolsheviks, but the press in the Western world was only listening to the Reds, who were telling them that their governments were supporting the whites. See, Marxist ideology says that if their people come to power somewhere, the capitalist states are going to support their enemies. So the ideology says that has to happen. So they had no choice but to believe, despite the fact that they're getting money and tons of stuff from the capitalist powers, they can't accept that ideologically. So when it turns out to be false, rather than abandoning the ideology, they simply reinvented reality. Well, either that, or they never really believed it in the first place. It's one of these cases where reporters without any specialized knowledge in the area just believe whatever they were told. So, even if you could find a period of time where there was some very, you know, minor assistance given to the whites, these are the conditions. Huge trade concessions. Taking money from czarist bank accounts in the West. And of course, the big German condition, I'm sorry, the big British condition was full assumption of the war debt in British and French banks. Anything that the whites got very early in the war, it was strictly on a commercial basis. It was an exchange. It wasn't aid. You know, often, you know, captured Russian warehouses of the Tsarist army were then sold back to them. And if any, if they received anything, the payment was in Russian raw materials, grain, gold, and of course, Russian funds in Western banks. Much more was exported from the country than was imported in terms of weapons. And what was sent was pretty useless and very, at a very low level. Kolchak was promised assistance and recognition if he recognized the entire public debt of Russia, you know, short-term debt of Russia during the war. But of course, the minute the war ended, that went out the window. The murder of Kolchak came about when he was treacherously extradited by the French general Yanin. You know, in the worst possible, most treacherous way, betrayed him and handed him over to the Reds. Even in April of 1920, the British even went to Denikin, and his successor Rangel requested that they end the fight and integrate with the Red Army, trying to disarm them. Then maybe they'll get some assistance. Now, there is one exception to this. French President Alexandre Millerand did provide short-term support to the Rangel forces in Crimea in order to save Poland. See, Rangel's army attacked the Reds, of course, and distracted some of their forces from the Polish front because they were at war with the new Polish government. So in August of 1920, the French recognized Rangel kind of de facto, so they could use pre-revolutionary Russian funds stored abroad to purchase equipment and, of course, pay the state debt of Russia. Rangel was hurt, not helped by this, and all the money that had been stored in Russian bank accounts in the West had been stolen by this point. Poland was fighting the Red Army. So to save Poland, assisting Rangel in Crimea, forcing the Reds fighting on two fronts, is why he got some purely de facto recognition. Pilsudski, the nationalist Polish leader, openly refused, even though they had a common enemy, refused to do anything to assist the white forces. And then in October 1920, a Polish-Soviet treaty was signed in Riga. And then once that war was over, he threw the liberated troops then to Wrangel. And you see here, you know, the problem. So you had a large Polish army with a talented military leader. You had the Ukrainian Directory. Then, of course, Wrangel's own forces. Three substantial armies with some talented commanders refusing to cooperate, either because of ethnic or personal or ideological differences. The low-level loans that were given to Wrangel were at an extremely high rate of interest. And of course, you know, the conditions were extremely burdensome. They never actually took place. The French demanded bread, coal, and wool, which were needed in Crimea itself. The French wanted to receive from Wrangel the payment of the debts of his predecessor. Of all the actual deliveries, and very few deliveries actually took place, one steamboat managed to arrive with stocks of things totally worthless for the war effort. In essence, what I'm trying to say here is that the whites were scammed over and over and over again. The whites wanted the debt paid. They wanted access to these bank accounts. They wanted Russian raw materials, and they were willing to tell the white leaders anything. The white generals, thinking that finally they've seen reason or on our side now, made deals with them on extremely burdensome conditions and were scammed. It's an absolute disaster. Wall Street, of course, sent its people to Russia under the guise of the Red Cross mission. And the director, of course, the director of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, W.B. Thompson. And W.B. Thompson was one of the main propagandists for Soviet Russia, Soviet Union, I should say, in the West. And of course, he was assisted by Lord Milner, who also not only who was actively involved in the February Revolution, director of the London Joint Stock Bank. And through Milner, the British government had informal relations with the Bolsheviks. And of course, they had their agent, Bruce Lockhart, who was fluent in Russian. And both Milner and Lloyd George personally knew and chose to lead this. The French chose Jacob Sadoul, an old friend of Trotsky's, very sympathetic to the Bolsheviks, as their representative. They sent a cadre, both powers sent a cadre into Russia, highly sympathetic to the Red Movement. Lockhart was treated like royalty. Trotsky wrote a document when Lockhart came representative of the British banks. He said, "I ask all organizations, councils, and commissars of stations to provide all possible assistance to the members of the English missions, R.B. Lockhart, W.L. Hicks, and D. Gersten, Commissioner for Foreign Affairs, L. Trotsky." Even Lockhart and Sadoul sent reports to their governments saying that Allied intervention to help the whites against the Bolsheviks would be doomed to failure, and only the intervention to help the Bolsheviks against the Germans could save the situation. The French, Sadoul, said they must use the new revolutionary army for this to give the opportunity to carry out a general mobilization, not in the old Czarist war, but in a new revolutionary war with the stronghold of reaction, Germany, and thereby to save the young revolutionary republic. So the French plan was to create a revolutionary leftist force that would then attack Germany, that they would then portray as this reactionary, you know, feudal society. Even General Wrangel's representative made it very clear that the Red Cross mission was also an intelligence operation and military information to the Bolsheviks, where they were assisting whites, you know, wounded people or whatever it is, and they were using this as a base to transmit intelligence to the Reds. And it was around this time they invented the notion of Lenin's amnesty. Even the Americans in the Far East wondered why, and this is a quote here, wonder why the Russian intelligentsia is fighting against such an advanced party as the Bolsheviks. The American command established good neighborly relations with the Red Partisans. And of course, this was a huge part of destroying Kolchak's whole movement. And Kolchak even was willing to remove American troops even in April 1919. And his one of his officers, Sukin, reports the withdrawal of the American troops is the only way to maintain friendly relations with the U.S. They almost came to fight one another. But every document you come across shows that whatever, these only a few thousand men in Russia had nothing to do with any combat operation, but they were there for their own financial interest, supporting the Reds ideologically as this new revolutionary democracy to fight, you know, the reactionary Germans, support these independent states, you know, Finland, and, you know, the Baltics, to guard the Trans-Siberian Railway, to keep it from the Japanese. And no assistance was ever given to the whites whatsoever. There was rhetoric, but tons of gold were taken from them in exchange for absolutely nothing. You know, W.B. Thompson wrote the book, The Truth About Russia and the Bolsheviks. So this was Wall Street's representative, the Fed banker, one of the biggest names in the history of the Federal Reserve, openly, you know, wrote a full book supporting the Bolsheviks, that this is our future. And this is and this is what Lord George has to say about it. That we did our best to maintain friendly relations with the Bolsheviks, and we recognize that they are de facto rulers of the territory of Great Russia. We did not intend to overthrow the Bolshevik government in Moscow. We tried to give him the opportunity, while a war with Germany was going on, to crush the anti-Bolshevik formations and those movements outside Moscow whose inspirers are ready to fight against us, against the enemy, that is Germany. So Wilson believed that any attempt to intervene in Russia without the consent of the Soviet government would turn into a movement to overthrow the Soviet government and therefore restore czarism, which in Wilson's mind was the worst thing that could possibly happen. Lord George continues, he said, none of us had the slightest desire to restore czarism in Russia. We considered it important to restore the anti-German front in Russia. And of course, that's what the Bolsheviks were for. The communist regime, of course, was recognized shortly thereafter. The conference in Genoa, 1921-22, was the first symbolic step of the Western states towards legitimizing their power. But this is happening while resistance is still going on in the Far East. Now, over the years, I've compiled a list of reasons why the whites ultimately were defeated. This has been asked thousands of times over, and of course, it's a tremendous lesson for us today. And of course, I could come up with hundreds of them. But those that stand alone, and this is just a few, the main one I'm willing to say was the fragmented nature of the command. Even Trotsky said that they occupied a central position and acted from a single center. They were able to transfer forces very effectively, while the whites, of course, were scattered all over the empire. Another important, extremely important aspect of it was the Reds used terror and hostage-taking as a regular part of their mobilization. You know, you take hostages, so the elites of a certain area start working for you. Shooting hostages was a normal thing for them. They introduced collective responsibility. Even decimation was used. Any retreat was met with execution. Trotsky himself wrote, "We must put the soldiers between a possible death ahead and inevitable death behind." In other words, you retreat, you get shot by us. those who had specialized knowledge had their families taken hostage. This is why 20% of the old general staff ended up joining the Bolsheviks. Their relatives were in trouble. And Lenin himself said, we're going to force our adversaries to build communism. And let Lenin explain Trotsky's method. And of course, they used the commissar system, where party people were put in each military unit, and commanders could be overruled by him. He had a right to arrest the commander. The commander, Vasitas, the commander of the Latvian division, wrote to Lenin. He said, discipline in our army is based on harsh punishments, especially executions. By merciless punishments and executions, we brought terror to everyone, to the Red Army commanders, to commissars. Execution on the front is practiced so often on all kinds of occasions that our discipline in the Red Army could be called, in a full sense of the word, purely bloody. Now, it's true that they were able to create a huge army, but also they had a large problem with deserters. In 1919, 1.7 million were detained for this crime. But the whites couldn't do anything like this. They couldn't use such methods. So the use of terror was extremely common. Third, of course, you have the, you know, huge internationalist brigades, about 300,000 of them, used by the Reds. This was a shock corps of the Red Army, the punitive detachments, as they're called, because foreigners have no sympathy for a foreign ethnicity. The Latvian commander, Nečimsen, of course, was Jewish, the Jewish commander of the Latvian Rifle Detachment of the 12th Army. And by 1918, the internationalist part of their army was almost 20% of their force. And of course, the Jewish side is well known, and that gives them a huge advantage. This is the high percentage of foreigners is unique in the history of civil wars. You know, using shock forces and punitive detachments the way that they did, using foreigners, this is something new. And of course, importantly, the use of criminals to cause chaos, opening the prisons, Lenin's encouragement of robberies, of separatism, all of this. The whites struggled with these anarchist groups and criminal forces that didn't want any order to be restored at all. All these politicians proclaiming independence of their little fiefs, you know, like Nestor Makhno's movement, that played a huge role in the defeat of Denikin in the autumn of 1919 and Wrangel in the autumn of 1920. I've said many times before, of course, the total lack of any ideological vision. Really, the two royalists, the two orthodox nationalist monarchists in the White Army were General Fyodor Keller. And as I mentioned, Dietrich. General Keller, of course, is an Orthodox man with German background. He refused to swear any kind of fealty to the provisional government, unlike Denikin. And was at war with Kornilov, calling him a revolutionary. And he said, only an ideology dedicated to royalism can assist us. And he had gone to Hetman Skoropadze in Ukraine, I did a whole podcast on before, to create this unified royalist white army with a coherent both political and spiritual program. But Denikin vetoed that. Keller even had all offers. I mean, he was part of the defense of Kiev. He was captured by the Masonic Directory in Ukraine and shot in the back. Those followers of Petluria. And his murder in 1918 deprived the whites of really the man who really could create an ideological core. Keller was a highly talented general that was understood what was going on at the time. Keller also made it very clear that the Dietrich's as well, made it clear that the murder of the Tsar was a Jewish ritual. Remember something too, that as this is all going on, the Allied forces are saying that there's going to be no assistance or recognition of anything you guys do unless you have Jewish representation. Anyway, Keller had been betrayed by Denikin, and he was murdered by the not even Ukrainian nationalists. These were Freemasons. Something else, the total lack of spiritual unity. This is something that Keller was going to create. Remember, Saint Tikhon refused to give a blessing to Denikin, considering him too liberal and too close to Masonic circles. But another worthwhile thing to notice is that all of these, the peasant rebellions against the Reds were everywhere. And they had huge numbers. And they never became a part of the white movement. They never tried to integrate them into the white forces. They only had their own circles and that was it. It was a huge miscalculation. One of the reasons I think Dietrich's is one of the, Dietrich's and Keller are the two greatest of the white commanders, is that in 1922 there was a Zemensky Sobor on Russian soil, attempting to actually recreate old Russia. The Synod made it very clear that the loss of the monarchy is a reason for the chaos and the restoration of the dynasty. And they, of course, elected Kirill as head of the royal house. Now, little did they know that he had given his loyalty to the provisionals by that point. He wasn't there, which is a shame. But General Dietrich's made it clear that they were going to, Zemensky Sobor is the way to rebuild the society. And he was one of two royalist generals. And what he wanted to do was create this approach, especially to the peasantry. This was an orthodox war against materialism. And it worked for him. But this was rejected by the white leadership. Dietrich's wrote, just before succumbing to the onslaught of the Reds, he said, "I believe Russia will return to Christ Russia, Russia the anointed of God, that we were still unworthy of his grace at the Most High." Methodius, the Archbishop of Harbin and Manchuria, was the spiritual chairman of the Sobor. Of course, this is in the Far East. And his forces were overrun. He escaped into China. He died in 1937. With these men, they would have had a chance. Instead, they were betrayed not just by the Entente, but by their own commanders. So, the defeat of the whites, of course, is the worst thing that could have happened, the worst event of the 20th century. The white leadership was so deeply divided. And you could take all of the strategic and even financial elements. I mean, they had far more money. The whites had tremendous amount when they took Kazan, where the treasury was. They were dripping in gold, and yet no one would sell them anything. That's how dedicated the West was to a Bolshevik victory. Or they would sell them something, just not deliver it. And they were naively believing, oh, the war is going on, therefore that's the reason it's not showing up here. It's almost pathetic at this point. But even if somehow they were able to, spend this huge amount of money to get this equipment, the reasons for it, the conditions that the West was going to put on them were so tremendous that no one could have done it. And really starting in really just the end of 1918, already saying that you need to make peace with the Reds and integrate with the Red Army. And you can't go anywhere in any English language source where they don't say that these forces were there to overthrow the Bolsheviks. But Dietrich's and Keller were two great generals of the white forces that don't get very little attention. They were probably the only two royalists you know, when the Tsar allegedly issued his abdication, Keller did not believe it. And he wrote a letter to Nicholas saying, I don't think this is true. This is not possible. Whatever is happening, we're going to come and protect you. And of course, he never got it. But Keller understood that was not a legitimate abdication. I've, on this show, I've done this many times before, that the abdication was a scam. He did not write it. The whites were presented as this reactionary royalist force, and they were nothing of the kind. Many of their men were. But you had two relatively minor generals, although both were extremely talented. Now, Colonel Kuppel, I mentioned in the Ice March, was a royalist as well. But here you have Dietrich actually creating a Zemensky Sobor, trying to rebuild the country, fully understanding the situation and knowing what the murder of the royal family really was. So no matter what else the Reds had going for them, they had ideological uniformity. They didn't tell the outside world this, but that's something that the whites never had. There wasn't any spiritual connection. There was no ideological connection. And it should put a smile on your face that the most dedicated, loyal Russian Orthodox nationalists and monarchists were men without Russian names. People like Kappel, Dietrichs, Keller. Anyway, thank you everyone for listening. I'll talk to you next time. Bye-bye.